All right, coming out in 3, 2, and 1. Welcome in to Inside the Icebox here on the ESPN Houston YouTube channel. My name's Joe George alongside Jeremy Branham here for episode 2 of Inside the Icebox. And Jeremy, we've got a lot to get into today. The offense, it's been terrible. The starting pitching's been really good. And torpedo bats are apparently on the way to save the day for the Houston Astros. I kind of want to start there with the torpedo bats and then work our way backwards through the offense and the issues that have happened in the lineup. So apparently these things have existed for a little bit. Like, it's not something that just started this year. We just didn't really know about it. It reminds me a lot of the axe handle bat that was, you know, kind of in vogue in, like, what, 2019 or whatever that was. But what do you, like, just starting here, what do you think about these torpedo bats?
I think we're probably sensationalizing it. I don't know. It's weird. Like, we need more information, right? Like, we need more data to accurately figure out what's going on. I think it's worth trying, right? Like, not because the Astros are struggling. I think you should always be looking to try whatever. Like, I think innovation is very important. I think the Astros' golden era is built on innovation with TrackMan and all that. So, I mean, yeah, give it a shot. I saw a college baseball coach post that, yeah, look what I found, like an old metal torpedo bat from like several years ago. So I do think that people have been swinging this for a while. I don't remember the guy's name who was with the Yankees. I think he's with the Marlins now. I don't think it was like this, you know, innovative stroke of genius in his invention. No, I think it's a pretty sound idea. Okay. Player X isn't barreling up baseballs and he's getting it in on the handle. How can we help that? Okay. What if we kind of make the barrel fatter and give them a better opportunity to barrel the baseball? So I think it's going to be different for different players. You know, for a certain player, it might help. For another player, they might hate it. You know, the weight distribution, something that kind of is fishy to me. Because, I mean, it kind of comes to – it becomes more narrow towards the cap. Like, I feel like that would feel different swinging than if the weight was distributed a little bit more balanced and in the barrel. So I think for some guys, it's probably okay. I think for other guys, they're going to hate it, quite frankly. And I don't think that it's – you know, I really want to be like, Yankees are cheating. Look at those guys. They've been PEDs back in the, you know, when they were winning a bunch of World Series in the Torrey era. And, you know, Joe Girardi yelled on MLB Network how they used to get signs from the watch when he was standing at second. Like, I want to pound the table and say the Yankees are cheating. But I think we're making much ado about nothing, really.
Yeah, I think so, too. I heard Jeff Passan on a podcast, I think it was, that was explaining that it's more for guys that get jammed a lot. That, like, it's going to help those guys out who they struggle with getting the bat and the ball and they're getting jammed up. And, like, that's going to help them in this situation. It's just the Yankees, they played the worst so far rotation in all of baseball to start the year. And then you're seeing a couple guys have big time success. Ellie De La Cruz obviously had that like 11 RBI night for the Reds. We've seen Dansby Swanson go deep a couple times this year, which is unlike him. Both those guys using torpedo bats. So like the results early in the season are, I feel like, are just making us all feel like it's a huge deal. Anything about this strange to you though? Because for me it is that it seems like almost every team in baseball has some idea about the torpedo bats. Has said someone experimenting. And the Astros, they're getting it this coming weekend. They're going to work with it for like a week, it sounds like. And then they might, a couple guys might, if they like it, will start using it. I don't know. It's a big deal, little deal, no deal. Feels like they're behind the times on these torpedo bats a little bit.
Yeah, that's probably a bit concerning. You know, whether it was they didn't hear about it or they heard about it and dismissed it. I don't think either one's is a good thing. Now, like the importance of it, I don't like that. That to me is where the conversation lies. Like, do I wish the Astros had it at spring training so the guys could just touch it, so the guys could kind of feel it and mess around at BP and, you know, do that sort of stuff? Yeah, I wish they did, just in case it is significant, just in case it is important. You know, maybe a Jeremy Pena could benefit off of that, you know, whoever. So it is a little bit concerning that the, when you look at it from that point of view, that they would be behind in the times, because that's not how they were built. Like, you know, Jeff Luhnow was innovative and they call it the bleeding edge, where he was, you know, firing people and bringing in TrackMan and getting rid of scouts. And, you know, I always want to be on the front end of innovation rather than trailing behind. I feel that's how you get left behind. And even if it doesn't work, okay. Like, well, we tried. We didn't think that it was impactful for us. Cool. You did your due diligence. And I think doing your due diligence is important. So, yeah, if that is indeed true, that is a little concerning for an organization that used to be on the forefront as opposed to trailing everybody else.
Yeah, because the other part too, that, and we'll start to dive into the offense and just what we've seen from the lineup so far in the season. But, you know, with specifically the fact that they're struggling, I guess it makes me feel a little bit better that they're adding them now. I think it'd be weird to have a bunch of guys crushing the baseball and then all of a sudden be like, yeah, we're going to change your bat. You know, we're going to let you start trying to experiment. I feel like this is the opportune time to start trying to, you know, if you're going to not have them in spring, like we're talking about, like this is the right time to do it. It's still early in the year. They are struggling. You know, the other part about too, that I think that this torpedo bat thing for me, Jeremy, I think it might be a placebo thing a little bit too here. Like a confidence boost for guys that are having it. Like they're just seeing success and they're just more confident with the bat in their hands. It might not actually mean anything, but they just, you know, we know baseball is a confidence game. And if it's just making you feel more comfortable and better at the plate, like the ball's going to go farther or you're not going to get jammed as much, then I guess it works.
Yeah, you start finding some barrels, you start feeling pretty good about yourself. Yogi Berra, 90% of baseball is half mental. So the torpedo bat's helping your mentals and it helps your mentals. But, like, it also wouldn't surprise me if none of the Astros use it in a game. Like, oh, these torpedo bats are all the rage and, you know, these guys are scoring a bunch of runs and RBIs and home runs and all of that. It would not shock me if there's not a single Houston Astro that uses it in a game. I do think that we're over-glorifying its significance. Should you try it? Absolutely. If one guy starts using the torpedo bat and it becomes better for him and his numbers improve, it's worth it. So, yeah, it's maybe have it around in spring training. But I also think that we are overrating it. Yeah. I feel like we would have seen this a long time ago.
Yes. But, you know, the other part of it, too, for me is even if it's not a big deal, good. The pitching has become so intense, so yeah. – You know, the pitchers have such an advantage, whether it was spider tack and then, you know, now still having sticky stuff, but not as extreme and just ramping up the, you know, the RPMs in every pitch. And they're all these guys are throwing 100, 103 miles per hour. And for the hitters, like, there's not really much you can do besides focus on a different launch angle. So, like, kind of a balancing out for a general baseball sense, like, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world because – like these games have been more fun. So if they are working, like baseball is better with runs. It is more entertaining to the average fan if you see a team go out there and hit 3 home runs and drive in 9 runs versus a 1-0 shutout. I think a lot of fans.
Yeah, I think there's a balance there. Like I didn't love the high volume numbers during the steroid era. I thought that was too much. I thought that was going over the top. You're having these 15, 12 games all the time. Like if you go, I'm a bit of a baseball historian. Like I love the numbers aspect of it. Like these numbers used to be sacred, right? Like Hank Aaron's home run total used to be sacred. We all knew Babe Ruth's home run total growing up. And you like just pull up OPS, just pull up OPS career numbers. And you have like the top 25. There's like 10 dudes who are from the steroid era. They're like, yeah, those guys aren't all-time greats. So I don't like that really tarnished a lot of the sacred numbers of the game. So I guess I still hold on to that a little bit whenever, like, I don't want to go too far to the extreme where these offensive numbers get ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the torpedo bats are going to do that, but I don't want to change the game so much to where you're going to have 20, 50 home run hitters every single year. I don't want it to go that far. And I don't think that it will. Now, you're right about the pitching kind of, you know, taking over. It is hard to hit. Like, it's always been one of the hardest things to do in sports, if not the hardest thing to do in sports. And these pitchers have never been better because of the TrackMan era, because everybody's gearing for velo. Everybody's gearing for spin. And it's hard to hit, very hard to hit. Now, torpedo bats, I mean, you still got to touch it. Like, mm-hmm. You still have to touch the baseball. So I don't think it would impact strikeout numbers, really. It would impact, you know, barrel rate and home runs and all that stuff. But, I mean, if you have a torpedo bat and it is all the rage and it is, you know, great, you still have to make contact. Like, it's not going to help your strikeout numbers. Might help your power numbers, might help your batting average, but the strikeout rate will be your strikeout rate.
All right, so as we are recording this, and it's airing on the radio station as well, because remember, we are going to air this 6 o'clock on Thursday, so if you're watching on YouTube right now, you want to listen to the radio version, because it'll be slightly different. It'll air as soon as Jeremy and Joel get off the air on the Killer Bees. The Astros are hitting 178, have a collective 270 on-base percentage. Their OPS is 492. What do you think's going on, man? Because it's just been – this has been a grind to start the year for pretty much everyone not named Jose Altuve.
Yeah. I would like to believe that every big league team over a 6-game span is going to have a stretch like this. I think every team in baseball over a 6-game span is going to have a terrible stretch where they hit 178 as a team, where they have a 492 OPS as a team. Maybe not everybody, maybe almost everybody, but every team's going to have some struggles over a 6-game stretch. And it's 6 of 162, way too small of a sample. All of that stuff is very true. But it is also true that these are the first 6, and the first games of the season do get magnified. It is also true that this is a totally different look to the Houston Astros than we've seen over the years. Kyle Tucker is gone. Alex Bregman is gone. And I don't blame them for either one of those moves. I think Alex Bregman got overpaid. I think the Astros' offer for Bregman was more than I would give. I'm a big fan of trading players before they walk for just a compensation pick. And I like the Astros' return. I think in the long run, it's going to be good. Now, first 6 games of the 2025 season, it doesn't look good. But I think over the long run, it will. So I don't blame the Astros for those moves. But I think that because it's a new look, that the fear of the fan base is greater. Because you could trust Tucker, right? Unless it's the playoffs. Like, you knew what you were going to get from Alex Bregman. So it's like you have that safety net. You're a little secure because you know them. Isak Paredes, a bit of a wild card. He hasn't played in Houston. And even if you look at the numbers, like, he's a bit volatile. Low batting average guy, high on base guy. Has had stretches where he's shown good powers, had stretches where he's not. He wasn't good as a Cub. Whenever the Cubs traded for him. Like, that is a fact. Christian Walker, all these guys are going to be better than they've been in the first 6 games. But Christian Walker's 34 years old. Like, baseball players don't get better in their mid-30s. Like, you look at the natural trajectory of a baseball player outside of the PED era, their prime's 27, 28, 29 years old. So expecting Walker to be who he was the last 3 seasons is probably unrealistic. You're setting expectations that are probably not fair. Like, there's going to be slippage. Now, is he going to turn into Jose Abreu? He shouldn't. The slippage shouldn't be, a plateau, shouldn't fall off the cliff. But you're going to see a trajectory of Christian Walker's offensive numbers going down. Now, this is too great. But again, that fear lives in Astro fans. Cam Smith, I think Cam Smith's a fantastic prospect. I think he's going to have a good career. He's a rookie who has played 5 games above high A ball, who's seen 20 plate appearances. So you have that fear, like, oh, did they bring him up too early? So you don't have the safety net of the past. I think they're going to be fine. I think the offense is going to turn it around. I think they're going to be above average offensively by the end of the season. But because you don't feel secure with all of the moves that have been made, you don't know the guys as much, there is reason for concern. I mean, even if those guys pan out, your bottom of the order still stinks. Your bottom of the order is still lousy. Yiner's at bats annoy me. Like, he drives me nuts watching him, just because his plate discipline's awful and his pitch selection is awful. It drives me nuts. It triggers me because I know his potential. Like, if he had decent plate, just decent, just okay, not good, just decent plate discipline, he's a 25-30 home run guy. But if he's flailing at everything off the plate, why would a pitcher ever throw him a strike? Mm-hmm. So that aggravates me. So, there's reason for concern. I don't think that the Astros are going to be bad offensively, but they have not given a whole lot of optimism to an Astro fan base that is a little hesitant knowing what this team is.
I think it's a delicate balance, right? Because it's early in the season. You don't want to overreact. But with the changes, I think we still have to look at the history of what the Astros are. Like, think about, you and I have been working together for 2 years now, right? Just a little bit over. And think about how many times that we've done radio shows together or things like this, and what have we talked about? Batter's eye, failing at home, playoff losses. I mean, when's the last time they won a playoff game at home? It's been a while. It's been a real grind at Minute Maid. I don't understand it. It's not what the Mariners are going through, where they built a terrible ballpark and they changed the dimensions and they've turned that thing into a pitcher's park because clearly other teams can hit in Houston. I think that's the panic and the fear within the Astros fan base. It's like they just don't get why for 2 years now, and now the start of this season, the topic of conversation around the Astros is that they're terrible at home. And I don't know how you feel. I don't feel like there's any logic behind it. It just feels like they're in this giant rut, you know, over a large part of 2 years at Minute Maid Park. And the numbers might not even back that up, but it just feels that way, I think, for a lot of fans.
I think a lot of it is false. I don't really buy into it much, especially like you get a playoff series. Like, I mean, playoffs are such a crapshoot. It is a very small sample of, you know, baseball, which should be extracted over a very long season. You know, they've messed with the batter's eye. That's always been a topic of conversation. I remember Chandler Rome, you know, mentioned that in his article. And I believe what Chandler Rome reports. Like, I totally do. Could it be the mentality? Like, you know, we talk about baseball being a mental sport. Could that be, you know, kind of running rampant in the Astros clubhouse? Maybe, I guess. But a lot of these guys are new, too. Like, Walker, like, why would he have trouble hitting at Minute Maid or the Dyke in Park? Same thing with Isak Paredes. Like, he's new. Why would he have trouble hitting at the Dyke? Now, I did, as you were saying that, because I don't remember last year's regular season splits. Like, I did not know that. But as you were going through that, I pulled up their home-away splits from last year, and the numbers don't back it up. Mm-hmm. The Astros at home last year hit .267 with a .770 OPS. Away, they hit .257 with a .713 OPS. So the splits last year tell you that they hit better at home. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt. I mean, they hit 10 points better with a batting average, and their OPS was 57 points higher. Like, that's a pretty significant gap. So I don't believe in it. I know the frustration exists because we add more emphasis to the playoffs, and you're right, they haven't won a home game in the postseason in quite a while. Didn't last year, lost to Detroit. Didn't the year prior to that. Maybe in the early rounds. I can't remember. I'm sure
they did. They would have been the early rounds, but they obviously that Ranger series was won by every road game, right?
Yeah. So, they're 0-4 in the ALCS at home. So I think this is more of a myth that's been built on postseason struggles.
I agree.
Than actual truth. And the numbers last year during the regular season would back that up. Now, the Astros haven't played a road game this year. So, like, we have nothing to compare it to. And I don't really want to get into the comparing six games at home versus six games on the road. Like, you probably need to see 30, right? But again, you know, maybe, what if they're just a bad offense?
I think that's what people are. It feels like fans are, they're worried about the home stuff because the playoffs amplify. Like I said, the numbers don't really back it up. But it's been a topic of conversations for two seasons now. Like, it has been. You started slow last year at home, right? Yeah. It was tough then. I mean, last year was more the rotation was bad early in the season. But, you know, the lineup just isn't producing, and we'll see how it goes. And, I mean, do you think there is? Like, what's the percentage chance you think the lineup's just bad this year?
I think they're above average.
Yeah.
I think it's an above average offense. I think it has the potential to be good, but I also think it has the potential to be bad. Like, I like to look things in ranges. Like, oh, they're going to be a .271 hitting team. Okay, that's a bit ridiculous, like trying to pinpoint it to the exact batting average or the exact OPS. I like to look at things in ranges, like what is best case, what is worst case scenario. Best case scenario, I think they could be a good offense. Now, what would have to happen for them to be a good offense? Okay, Jose Altuve needs to not show any regression at 35 years old, which early in the year he is not. Isak Paredes needs to hit for some pop, get on base. I don't care what his batting average is. I care about his on-base percentage and how many dingers he hits. Yordan Alvarez. I mean, if you're going to be your best version of the Houston Astros offensively, Yordan Alvarez should be an MVP candidate. Like, that's what they're counting on him to be in order for them to be as good as they can be. Walker, same thing as Altuve. Don't show regression. Pena, can you take a step up? Not a giant leap, just a step up. Yiner Diaz, can you please help your plate discipline a little so you can revert back to hitting 20-something home runs you did as a rookie? That's why he didn't hit 20 home runs last year. Pitchers aren't giving him pitches to hit because they know he's going to do a pitcher a favor. Myers, can he show you a little bit of improvement? Can Chaz McCormick steal the job for Myers? You know, that is a way you can get better offensively. And then Cam Smith probably needs to be a big league hitter, right? Like, you can't – corner outfield spots, you need to be getting above average offensive production. And I like his promise a lot, but if Cam Smith is just out there, like, learning and not an above average offensive right fielder, well, the Astros can't reach their offensive potential. And then the other side of that is, okay, well, how would they hit their offensive floor? Well, injury. Injury is always something that factors into that. Altuve and Walker show their age a bit. Yordan Alvarez doesn't, you know, Yordan Alvarez has a pretty good year instead of an MVP type of year. Peña is who he is. Yiner doesn't show play discipline. No one really takes the reins of the center field position. So to me, it's somewhere in that range. That's kind of walking the fence, I guess. They're a little bit walking the line. But I think they have a chance to be a good offense even after a disastrous first six games. But I think that they've also showed us what the floor could be. They've also given us a little bit of taste of, you know, what if they're not good offensively? What does it look like? Well, it looks like this. This is what it looks like, Houston.
Is there anyone – I'm going to guess here, just based on what you've said so far about Yiner. If there is anyone to pinpoint of, like, someone you are actually concerned about, though, just six games into the season, yes, small sample size, is it Yiner? Because you're not seeing the improvement, the change to approach? Because that's where I kind of fall into it, is you just want it to be different. And it's not different with Yiner. Early in the season, he's still chasing things like crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you're just like, that's why, like, there's no concern with, you know, Alvarez or Isak or even, like you said, Walker as well. But for Yiner, I think he can be the best hitting catcher in all of baseball. It feels like to me, him and Adley Rutschman can be top two, and they can be going back and forth every year. But the discipline stuff is what I think is the, like you're saying, the long term concern. So would you pinpoint as that as like the one guy you're actually concerned about right now? It's not just the six game sample size.
Concern might be too big of a word. Okay. I don't want to get concerned after six games, but like, what am I paying more attention to? Like, what has caught my eye a little bit more? And the reason that I'm so harsh on Yiner is because I know his potential. Like, if Yiner was just, you know, a light hitting catcher, if he was Brad Ausmus, right? If he projected to be Brad Ausmus offensively, I don't really care too much about him chasing pitches out of the zone or being a bad offensive player. It's what his expectations are. It's what his talent and potential is. But because of his upside, Yiner can be a 300 hitter, hit 25, 30 home runs. He is capable of doing that with his bat to ball skills and with his power. What is preventing him from doing that? His plate discipline, his pitch selection, it's atrocious. It is awful. It is Altuve with a runner at third, less than two outs level bad, where they're just chasing everything because they think they can touch it all, and they can. But if you're touching a baseball, it's not the same as driving a baseball. And I think that's Yiner's problem. Now, this just might be who Yiner is, though. Like, Yiner's – I think that plate discipline is one of the hardest skills to learn once you get to this level. Maybe just pro ball, but especially at the big league level. Like, how many guys do you see have lousy plate discipline and all of a sudden they have great plate discipline? It's rare. Altuve early in his career to middle of his career was about the biggest difference I saw. But even in his best plate discipline days, it wasn't great. It got to a pretty good level. It was atrocious, got to pretty good. Now it's atrocious again.
Yeah.
Like, his career plight. So if Yiner just took the steps that Altuve took, I mean, Yiner would be in that conversation for best catchers, offensive catchers in baseball. That's what frustrates me because I know his potential. It wouldn't frustrate me as much if he didn't have any potential. Jeremy Peña is probably another one. Like, you know, great spring. And this is another example. Don't overreact to spring training, which we'll get into, you know, the next guy here in a little bit. But don't overreact to spring training numbers. It usually does not have any correlation of what they're going to do in the regular season. Again, six games, not saying that six games are going to tell the story, but do you put more stock in Jeremy Peña's first six games of the regular season or his entire spring training in the six games of the regular season? So, you know, it concerns me that Peña is not going to take an offensive step. He's just going to be a career average, you know, hitter that plays a pretty good shortstop, which is fine, but you think that he could have a ceiling that's higher as well. And then Cam Smith, like, not – not finishing even the chapter on Cam Smith at all. Like, this isn't knocking Cam Smith because he has incredible upside. The project, you know, the he projects to be a very, very good player. But it was a bold move. Like, you bring up a player of five games above single A, 20 plate appearances, higher than high A ball. Like, that's okay. Let's see what this looks like. Let's see how this goes. And I like, he's had some pretty good at bats, had a couple of hits. He's drawn some walks. Like, he has good plate discipline. But is he going to give you above average, you know, offensive production? Because if he doesn't, then it was too early. If he's not giving you above average offensive production, then calling him up was the wrong decision. And again, six games is not going to tell the story, but just something that has caught my eye.
Let's talk about Cam Smith for a little bit before we get into the pitching, because this is obviously, it's been an interesting couple days in Major League Baseball in terms of young prospects. We saw Jackson Merrill get a huge contract worth $135 million from the San Diego Padres. And we saw Christian Campbell, who made the Red Sox opening day roster, get an 8-year extension for, what, $90 million, I believe it was. And immediately, you know, you see the Schwabs of the world tweeting about Cam Smith. And I'm sure that was a topic of conversation for you guys as well about giving him a contract. Are you open to the idea of paying Cam Smith right now, even though, like, it's early, it's struggling, and Christian Campbell is having the benefit of he's smoking the baseball. As we were recording this, he hit another home run for the Red Sox. So, obviously, the start of their seasons is very different, but I would pay Cam Smith right now. I think, honestly, Jeremy, I think it's the logical move of the things that you could do for them. Because I was listening to Chandler Rome's podcast, and they were doing a mailbag, and they were asked about, you know, extending Hunter Brown. And he said, you missed that window 2 years ago when he was coming off, he was struggling. Like, you should have paid him then if you really believed in that guy. Because now Scott Boras, who he's hired, is never going to let him sign a contract unless it's a Godfather-level offer from the Astros, which, I don't know, doesn't exist. And I would sign up Cam Smith right now on an 8-year deal, 8-year extension right now, buy out 2 years of free agency, and just that way you have him longer than you have your typical guys who play here for 6 years and walk away. I do it right now. I have no hesitation.
I do think one area that we and everyone often ignore whenever we have these conversations is, well, what's the motive of the player? I mean, the Astros already, maybe they gave him a kid. Maybe they gave Cam Smith the Christian Campbell contract offer. We don't know that.
It's like, true.
It wasn't reported. So, you know, we think that it didn't happen, but it could have. So there's always the player motive. And sometimes we never discuss that part of it. Like, would you do this? Okay, well, the player's got a decision, too, here. It takes two to tango. Like, you know, you ask somebody out on a date, they have to say yes. Like, Cam Smith has to say yes. Christian Campbell had to say yes. But I would be interested in it, too, if from a front office perspective. I would do the due diligence. I would see where Cam Smith and his agent are at, and I would try to get something done as well. I actually posted the question, too, to the Twitter, and I was surprised with the reaction that I got saying no. It was a pretty overwhelming no, which is, it doesn't add up to me, because it was a pretty overwhelming yes that they wanted Cam Smith on the team. Because I think that those moves are actually lateral. I think they're parallel decisions. Like, if you're going to call Cam Smith up a year after he was drafted, five games above high A, 20 plate appearances above high A, Dana Brown is telling you, I trust my eye that this kid is going to be good. That this kid is going to be great. I'm putting my career on the line for Cam Smith by calling him up this early. So if you're making that decision, how are you not making the other decision of trying to lock up a young player and buy out some of his free agent years? I think those decisions have a lot of correlation. So I would be interested in doing it. I think that the best general managers are the ones that, like, us as fans and us that watch the game, we always look at the back of the baseball card. We're like, well, this guy did this. This guy did that. So what? It's not about what he did. It's about what he's going to do. And the best general managers in any sport are the ones that can best predict what's going to happen in the future. And with Dana Brown calling up Cam Smith this early into his career, he is telling you, my eyes predict that Cam Smith's going to be really good. Doesn't that also factor into the decision of locking up a young player? If his eyes are telling him that player is going to be really good, then his eyes should be saying we need to lock up that player. Now, this could have happened, and like we don't know again because we don't know what's going on in the negotiations and all of that. But if your GM's saying that he's so good that we have to get him up now, then your general manager should have no reservations of signing him to an 8-year deal and buying out his free agent years. I like these type of contracts a lot. Looking at things from a team building point of view, I do not like paying players in their 30s huge money. Like, I would have never done the Gerrit Cole contract. I would have never done the George Springer contract. I would have never done the Carlos Correa contract. I wouldn't have offered Bregman what the Astros offered Bregman. I am in favor of trading free agents before they leave. I like the Tucker trade, even though Tucker's killing the ball right now for the Cubs. What if you traded Bregman a year early and got you're not going to get as much as you got for Tucker because Tucker's a better player. But what if you traded a Bregman a year early? Like, what did the final year of Bregman give you? It got you a 2-2 in the wild card round of Detroit. So I'm more in favor of trading players before they leave, not paying players big contracts in their mid 30s. Like, I'm going to bring in the Michael Brantleys of the world. Like, I'll pay Michael Brantley $30 million for 2 years and have a really solid bat in left field. But I'm not going to give them 6-7-8-year contracts. That's something I will not do. But what about when they're 22 years old? You want to give them 8 years when they're 22? That way you have them in all of their prime years. Mm-hmm. If you trust your eyes, you should be doing that. And then when those 8 years are up, you hope that he's good. And maybe you trade him before that final year. You let him walk in free agency. But you stole his best years. You stole his prime years. The Astros have, like, whenever I post this on Twitter too, like, well, how did it work out for John Singleton? Well, how did it work out for Jose Altuve? Like, you combine the Singleton and Altuve contracts, and I would do that every single time. So I don't care that it didn't work for Singleton. All it had to do was work for one. And in fact, you could have given five guys those contracts, and if four failed and one Altuve emerges, that was a win. Somebody said, well, how did the Rafael Montero contract work? How are you comparing Rafael Montero to a 22-year-old?
Yeah, if anything, like, the conversation should almost be, are you going to do this with anyone else? Like, because I feel like you've missed the boat on Yiner.
Well, no, Yiner maybe not. Yiner maybe not. This probably needs to be done this year.
What about Pena?
Pena's going into his fourth year. He's getting arbitration money, so that's a significant jump. And plus, you might even have, like, it might not be in the best interest of the team now for Pena. Because what is Pena? Is Pena just this league average shortstop? Because if a league average shortstop, you don't want to pay $20-25 million to. So you might – waiting on Pena actually might have given you a favor. Because you might have overpaid for Pena if you did it a year or two ago.
And now Pena's a guy
that you play 6 years for us, you leave. Maybe we get a compensation pick and we move on. Like, to me, Pena is that level of player. Yiner, because of his potential, and even this Yiner, I know I've sounded sour on Yiner, but even Yiner last year was an above average catcher in baseball. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're still paying an above average catcher in baseball if he doesn't improve at all. He has the potential of becoming the best offensive catcher in the baseball. So I would pay Yiner. I would extend Yiner. Maybe not like an 8-9 year deal, but I would be trying to buy out a few years of his free agency for sure. And same thing with Cam Smith. Like, if you're telling me he's so good, he must be on the team now. You're also telling me that you should pay the guy.
Before we get to the rotation, what about Arrigetti? Would you offer Spencer Arrigetti a lengthy contract right now, buy out some free agency?
I hadn't thought about Arrigetti. So I also, like, I have a theory of not paying players in their 30s. I also don't like giving big money to pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Because what do pitchers do?
Tommy John.
Blow out their elbow. So, like, you give a pitcher a huge contract for 6 years, Tommy John, if they're Luis Garcia, they've just missed 2 years. So I don't think that there's value in the long term of paying pitchers. Individual cases, could they work out? Yes, absolutely. Maybe they could avoid injury, have 6 really good years. But I think over, a very broad look at the starting pitcher landscape and what those big contracts look like, I feel like it's more of a risk on the pitcher side than the hitter side. So I don't love buying out free agency years of pitchers. I actually like what the Astros have done. I don't know if they did this intentionally. They might have stumbled into it. But like Fromber. Like, Fromber's going to enter free agency in his 30s. Why? Because he got a late start.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a terrible idea. Like, you get 6 years of club control, right? So if you call up a guy, and not to say that you're going to, you know, service time manipulation, but Fromber signed late. Like, he was one of the international players that signed late in, you know, his life. And a lot of scouts were souring away from that because they didn't want to sign pitchers that were older. Mm-hmm. But then you start to, like, do the math on it. Well, okay, well, if he's making his big league debut at 24, you're going to have him until 30. Well, you got the pitcher in the best years of his life if you're only going to keep him for 6 years. So I like Arrigetti. I think Arrigetti has number two, number three in the rotation. Potentially, he is the Astros number three right now. But because I don't believe in paying pitchers big money for a lot of years, I probably would not with Arrigetti.
No, that makes sense. I think that's fair. I just think it's if you're looking at guys to pay, he'd probably be, since you missed the boat on Hunter Brown, mm-hmm. if you believe in Arrigetti, you have to kind of factor that in. You know, the other one that'll be interesting with Yiner, I just would say, is I know he's had only a small amount of appearances and it was kind of a struggle bus looking at some of the statistics from last year. I do wonder how Walker Yannick, you know, kind of fits into this, the Astros first round pick, who was a catcher from a couple years ago. Because, like, there's obviously, like, your DH spot's taken. So I just feel like it limits you on where you're going to move guys. I don't know if he can play third, if they were looking at something like that for him. But I wonder if that factors into the Yiner stuff, too, of what Dana's prospect evaluation would be of Walker if, you know, if they're a believer, if that would factor into giving Yiner at least a contract right now. So, all right, let's talk about the rotation.
I don't think the general managers look at prospects that are that far away to impact their big league player decisions at all. Like, people, oh, they drafted a catcher. What does this mean for Yiner? Nothing. Like, there's a really good chance that a first round player, especially late first round, never makes it to the bigs.
Yeah.
I like Yannick. I think he will, but that's the reality of the situation. They're not drafting players based on their current personnel. So, and they're not even worried about that until they're knocking on the door. Like, maybe Bryce Matthews factored into the decision to, like, make Jose Altuve a left fielder. Maybe. But even that feels like a little bit of a stretch. I don't think Yannick can play anywhere else. Like, he could defensively, but I think his bat, he has to be a catcher. Like, he'll be okay, I think, offensively as a catcher. But I don't think his bat would ever play at third or first.
All right, so Astros rotation has a 2.79 ERA, third in the American League. All five starters pitched at least five innings their first time through the rotation. 2.81 ERA from the bullpen. I guess this would have been before Fromber got lit up a little bit, so it might be a little bit higher.
I see 3.33.
Yeah, so this was before Fromber got lit up by the Giants. What do you make of the rotation so far through? As expected? More than expected from these guys?
I was probably a little bit more on the lofty expectations to start the year than most. So this is kind of what I expected. Maybe if you were just pulling, like, the consensus of the popular opinion that it's probably, you know, outdone it a bit. One trip through. Fromber was fantastic his first start, not so fantastic his second start. I think the world of Hunter Brown. I think Hunter Brown could win an American League Cy Young. Like, that's how good his stuff is. That's how highly I think of him. So, yeah, I mean, those two at the top of the rotation, like, I would take those 1-2 against just about anybody. Arrigetti's development this year is going to be critical. Like, is he going to solidify himself as a true number three starter in the bigs? And I like his stuff, man. His stuff's pretty sick. I like his mentality. Like, he thinks the game. Like, he's a pitcher. So I have high hopes for Arrigetti. Blanco's kind of a weird guy because, you know, so good last year, but was it a one-hit wonder? I thought he was pretty good in his first outing. One of the concerns I have with Blanco, though, is his controlling the run game. The Giants were taking second on him every chance that they had. Reminded me of Christian Javier last year. Anytime that a base runner was on, they were running on Christian Javier. So that's something that I'm paying attention to. Like, can that be cleaned up? Because if not, and look, Blanco's great at avoiding, you know, one of the best opponent batting average in baseball in the American League. It might have been the best, I think. But you allow a runner on, all of a sudden he's at second. You got a runner in scoring position. Even if there's two outs, now that's a stressful inning. You could have retired you could have punched out the first two, been dominant. You give up a little roll, like a swinging bunt. He's at first base. Now he's at second because he's stealing on you. Now it turns into a stressful inning when it shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
So that kind of catches my eye with Blanco. Hopefully he can clean that up. I liked Wesneski's stuff when I saw of his. I thought that his stuff was pretty good. Now he committed the, you know, the crime of walking the 8 and 9 hole hitters the other night. Like your stuff, man. But if you're going to make a habit of walking the 8 and 9 hole hitters on the other team, you're not going to be in the rotation very long. Like that cannot happen. His stuff plays, but is that something that's going to like show up a lot with him? Like I haven't seen him enough to know that. Hopefully it was an anomaly, but you got to challenge those guys. Like walks are never okay. They're a little bit more acceptable if it's the cleanup man with first base open. You cannot walk the 8 and the 9 hole. So I was very disappointed in that with Wesneski. So short-term view, didn't love that. Long-term view, I was pretty pleased with his stuff, though.
And then I think it's been pretty good so far. I mean, Fromber obviously not the best versus the Giants. But, yeah. You know,
he does every now and then.
Yeah, he's going to. I mean, this has the potential to be one of the top rotations in the American League. I'm with you. I was pretty bullish on these guys. I've got a ticket on what it ended up being, plus 2,500 for Hunter Brown Cy Young this year. I did a small little ticket on that one. Just take a little flyer on it. So I figured, why not? So but I'm pretty bullish on this rotation too. And we even saw him pitch in a baseball game, Lance McCullers. It's only 2 innings, but it feels like we still have a long way to go because we've seen, obviously, like Luis Garcia start to ramp up and then get shut down. But we know that this coming weekend, Lance will pitch again in Double-A. And I think that kind of factors into what you're saying there, Jeremy, about Wesneski. It's just that if that he is the odd man out when Lance McCullers returns. Honestly, I think no matter what, if Lance actually comes back, I would be – I don't see a world where Blanco is moved to the bullpen, but I don't really know what their other move would be unless they go 6-man rotation.
I think that's it. I think a 6-man rotation makes sense because you want to keep Fromber fresh. You want to keep him strong. You want to keep Hunter Brown strong. And look, Hunter Brown's still early in his career, right? Like he hadn't logged tons of innings over his big league career. So I think the 6-man rotation's the play. Keeps Fromber fresh. You know, when I'm breaking down at the end of the year, keeps Hunter Brown fresh and, you know, you're not taxing him with a huge workload. Eric Geddy's only in his second season. Like, I think it benefits him. Rennell Blanco, you know, I'm not, you know, if he's,
I mean, he blew past his like innings pitch in his career last year. He's going to probably try to do it again this year. So
I'm not as worried about a 31-year-old logging a bunch of innings, but at the same time, like, is he a guy that you must start every fifth day? No, he's not a guy that you must start every fifth day. Same thing with Wesneski. Is he a guy you must start every fifth day? Like, is he Gerrit Cole in his prime where you better start him every fifth day? Verlander in his prime, you better start him every fifth day. And then Lance McCullers would benefit being in a 6-man too, just to give him an extra day. So I think the 6-man makes a lot of sense. Now, there is a timeline for Lance McCullers, unless he re-aggravates an injury and has to get placed back on the IL, because rehab stints for pitchers are 30 days. Mm-hmm. So he has 30 days, and the Astros have to make a decision either to bring him back up on the roster or to place him on the IL again. So there is a timeline here. Like, it's real. Like, we haven't really allowed ourselves to think that. I was having a conversation with some buddies yesterday about it. I was like, because they were like, well, who knows when we see him? I was like, well, they might have to make a decision, not – tomorrow, but at the end of April. He started his rehab April 1st ish somewhere around there over the past weekend. Maybe he was still,
I guess it's end of March. Yeah,
but so that's the end of April, like 30 days end of April. So
I mean, if you think logically, like if he pitches 2 innings, the goal would probably be to increase that to 4 innings this coming weekend in Corpus or wherever they're playing, and then the following weekend increase that to the pitch count that it would equal, you know, 6-7 innings, probably the next start, and then probably be in the bigs by the end of the month. Like, maybe get a fourth rehab stint.
Yeah, I think
in there, but like,
I think your jumps were a little bit too big, kind of
too big
margins. Yeah, I don't think you want to throw in 6 innings in his third rehab start. Like that's a bit much. How many pitches did he throw in his first one? Was like,
I'm not even sure actually.
Let's just say it was 20-something. Let's just say 20 for the sake of numbers and easy math, right? Let's say it was 20. Okay, we'll ramp him up to 30-35 in his second start. Ramp him up to 50-55 in his third start. Ramp him up to 70-75 in his fourth and final rehab start before you bring him back up. I think that's a good place to be. And then, you know, his first few starts at the big league level, he's not going to throw 100 pitches.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to be somewhere around 70-75 too.
He threw 35.
Oh, that's more than I thought. Okay. So you can go 35 to maybe 45, 45 to 55, 55 to 65. And then his final start, he's throwing 65 pitches. Like, I think that would be a decent spot for him. And again, look, and maybe you go piggyback. Like, we're talking 6-man. Maybe you go piggyback with Lance.
Wesneski can be the piggyback for that, for sure.
Like, I think that's in play too. It kind of depends on the calendar, right? Like, yeah. If you have a bunch of off days, six man doesn't make as much sense. If you have a bunch of games in a row, six man makes more sense. But, you know, Lance McCullers isn't throwing 100 pitches in his first big league start. So I think that'd be a good spot to have him. Maybe 10 pitch increment, 35, 45, 45 to 55, 55 to 65. And then he can give you somewhere around 70 pitches or so in his first big league start. If it happens, if he can make it through the rehab healthy.
I hate to feel like this because I don't want to be let down, Jeremy. But I feel like it's coming this year. So I feel like it's
like on what's its coming
that we're going to see the return of Lance McCullers for the Astros.
It's trending that way.
I know. So
I mean, it's trending that way. I like his attitude though. Like I made fun of Lance McCullers a lot. It triggered me when he's posting social media of throwing bullpens, like because I'm an oversell, under deliver kind of guy. No, I said that backwards. My wife would argue that's probably true. No, I'm an undersell, over-deliver guy. And when you're blasting pictures and videos on social media, if you throw in bullpens and then you get hurt, like that's the epitome of overselling, under-delivering. But this year has been different. Like I haven't seen any of that stuff. Like I've liked his attitude, talking to the media. Like he's putting in the work as opposed to like talking about what's going on. So that's encouraged me. Now all my ire is on Luis Garcia. Like, what's going on with you, man? Are you taking your rehab seriously? Like, this is a little bit of annoying to me.
Vibe is not great around Luis Garcia.
It's like he's sitting in the dugout with those little fake glasses and stuff. I don't love that. Like, go work out. Like,
yeah.
And that's my frustration. I'm being a little bit, you know.
No, my gut tells me we're headed to another Tommy John for Luis. It just feels like
that. Shut him down for what, 4 weeks?
I know.
4 weeks. Like shut down for 4 weeks.
He's been shut down how many times in the last calendar year?
At least three times. This would be at least three.
Yeah,
and it could have been one in the offseason they didn't tell us about.
Yeah, so it's not great. All right, that will do it for this episode of Inside the Icebox. Remember, you can find us here on ESPN Houston's YouTube channel. Remember, like, subscribe, helps the algorithm, all those kind of things. When you do that, when you watch the video, he is Jeremy Brandon. My name is Joe George. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for watching. Peace.